It's your headline to unpack.
It's your one story to follow week by week.
It's your Wordle to work through.
It's your team to track.
It's your 36 hours to explore.
It's your marinade to master.
It's your opinion to figure out.
It's your mattress to upgrade.
It's your day to know what else you need to know today.
The New York Times. It's your world to understand. Find out more at nytimes.com/yourworld.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your shape of you of music, news, and criticism. I'm John Caramonica, a critic of the New York Times.
I'm Joe Coscarelli. I'm a culture reporter at the New York Times.
I'm Ed Sheeran, and I'm here to be interviewed by the New York Times.
Bing bong.
Let's go.
It's go time. Ed Sheeran is in the building. Ed Sheeran is, I think it is safe to say, a nuclear-grade pop star firmly at the top of the mountain.
Raised in Suffolk, England, Ed Sheeran has spent the last decade and a half becoming one of the defining musicians of the modern era. Best known for songs that have become the new wedding standards, Thinking Out Loud.
People fall in love in mysterious way.
Perfect.
Because we were just kids when we fell.
The A-Team.
Nobody plays the A-Team at their wedding, just for the record. Depressing-ass wedding.
Outside.
You know Ed Sheeran songs, even if you're not sure you know Ed Sheeran songs.
Ed Sheeran might be the only artist who's worked with Taylor Swift, The Weeknd, Beyonce, Justin Bieber, and Meek Mill and Young Thug.
What's made all that success even more remarkable is that it started with incredibly humble beginnings. If you ever saw him perform early in his career, what you saw is one guy, one guitar, and one loop pedal on street corners and in tiny venues, and took that all the way to stadiums. He's just finished a huge European stadium tour. He's got two small children.
And a new album, Play, his eighth studio album, comes out Friday, September 12th.
And squeezing in between all of those responsibilities, Ed Sheeran is here on the couch on Popcast. Ed, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's jump right in. You have an album coming out immediately.
Yeah.
Like right now.
Right.
Like you might press a button while we're sitting here. So obviously the first question that everybody wants to know is, have you heard The Life of a Showgirl?
No, I haven't. Have you?
No. Have you?
Still under lock and key.
When I made Everything Has Changed for Red,
yeah.
I remember someone flying out with like a padlocked suitcase
to
pay me the mix of the song.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Like that's how like under lock and key that stuff is.
I was surprised when she did the thing where she like went on the podcast and had it in the briefcase. I was like, that briefcase isn't even locked.
Yeah, yeah, like where's
like,
the
there's just a lock.
For real is a thing though.
Yeah,
that actually is a thing.
Oh yeah, the brief.
Yeah,
yes.
It was like when iPods are a thing and came and you listen to the mix, you're like cool.
Oh, yeah. And then they do that back on the jet.
And that's that's 2012. So that's like
you can only imagine what it's like now.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
But you're here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Play coming out on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's been quite a big build up for you.
Yeah, I felt like I kind of had to reheat a little bit.
Talk about that a little bit. Like, what was your plan coming in? You put out two albums in 2023.
Yeah, I just made a lot of music with Aaron, and I wanted to kind of clear the decks, if that makes sense. I didn't want to like hold on to anything and just wanted to put out the music that I'd made and move on to the next thing. But that whole campaign, because that album was like about grief and depression, the whole campaign around it, it had to like mirror the record. So it was quite a serious campaign. And the shows we were doing it, we play the album in full. I'd explain all the stories about the songs. And it was quite a heavy like year of that. And so with this record, I knew I wanted to have like a long lead into it, release a lot of music and have fun whilst doing it. So it wasn't like, it didn't feel promotion-y. So all the stuff we've been doing has just been literally stuff I want to do.
And also, like, it feels like a classic rollout. Like, obviously, right now you have a lot of the surprise releases no longer are a surprise. You can sort of have this announcement. You're like, I'm going to release this surprise album in 2 weeks. And then people just drop an album.
Yeah.
And that's the event. With the rollout of singles, I'm just like, oh, no, this is like the 90s or 2000s.
I don't think I'm that artist. Yeah. Like, I don't have a very day one fan base. My fan base do take a while to find things. I'd say, like, Shivers and Bad Habits both ended up being quite big hits,
yep.
but they took a long time to like find a rhythm. Azzy Zam's the same, and Sapphire. And like my fans, just they're not like a show up day one stream 20 million times type fans, but over the course of a year, they do. So I knew my rollout just has to be a bit more traditional. I think because I'm 34 and I've been doing it for 15 years, like it's not the same as it was when I was a teenager and I had teenage fans. You know,
yeah.
my fans have kids and...
And you have kids.
Yeah, yes. but they take longer to find that they're not like actively seeking out new music every
sure.
day. So my radio is still, I know people like go back and forth on whether radio is important anymore, but it certainly is to me.
Yeah.
And I really feel like it creates hits and keeps hits. And yeah, I think I just have to like know who my fan base are, and my fan base take a while to find a song like Azzy Zam, you know?
And is that something, one of the things when we spoke a decade ago, one of the things you said to me that really no true pop star had ever said to me was how much you love statistics
yeah.
and how sort of focused you are on that aspect of the business. And I wonder, is that what's informing what you just described? Like, are you still granular on the charts, granular on the streaming data, things like that?
I got to be honest, I sort of got over all of that, I'd say, end of Divide tour.
Okay.
And I think all of that was linked to being a like quite unpopular nerdy kid at school who played music that everyone took the piss out of, and no one ever really thought that I'd be successful. And I moved to, I remember all of my friends being yeah. like, what are you doing? and then success starting to happen and me getting obsessed with the fact that success was happening and it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger and being like, how far can I push this? And I think that it's kind of like, I describe it if Usain Bolt sets a record, someone's going to break that record yeah. eventually. And I think he's probably got over that fact. But I think I was like, everything I was doing seemed to be working and I was pushing it further and further. And I think after the Divide tour had broken the records and Shape of You had done this and done this, I think... throughout, but maybe having children and stuff, kind of got to a point where I was like, cool, I've done it. Someone else is going to beat those records, but at least I've done it. And then you can kind of move on from there. But it does stem from, I think any pop star's need for people to like them stems
sure.
from
validation.
School. I think it stems from school, yeah.
But also you seem competitive. Like you mentioned the Usain Bolt metaphor, and like if you tease that out a little bit, it's like Usain Bolt loses the ability to run as fast physically because of age and wear and tear and whatever. You being a pop star for 15 years, maybe you lose a little bit of the thrill of the new that you would have with your fan base, but you're still able to make huge hits.
Yeah.
Do you still feel that need to, like, you know, these last couple singles, like, I don't think have reached the top 40 in the US.
No.
Like, is that something you look at and you're like, oh, like, I just need another top 40, another top 10, another number one?
I don't know,
or have you totally lost that?
No, I think... Well, firstly, I feel like I knew that going into this camp. Like Azzy Zam as a lead, it's quite a, like some press in the UK said it was like predictable, but I think like Iranian fused folk pop as a first single,
yeah.
it's kind of risky. Of risky
and, Gougouche, though.
Yeah, exactly, but I felt that I kind of just want to touch new ground in my career rather than travel over the same things, even if I know it's going to work. For me, the risk is actually the exciting part of it, and my read on it is not necessarily like chart positions anymore, but it's like, does it slap in the live show?
How does it fit into the set list?
Well, because that's kind of that is the end goal. I want people to come to the shows and love it, and it does, and it fits in, and people know it, and people jump around, and yeah, that's more of a measure of success for me now, I think. Yeah, I'm the last, how long has it been, 6 years since Divide Tour ended, has been a shift of, I have two young girls, I have a family, a wife, a home. that pop is a young person's game and you have to really, really be in it and want it. And I've found myself stepping back more and more and being like, actually, I'm really valuing family. So I dropped off my kid at her first day of school today.
Sure.
I fit this pod. Yes. Thank you. But like, I've like fit this around. And whereas before, like I hung out with Alex Warren at Coachella, and Ordinary had, you know, it's really, really having a moment at the moment. And he was like 16 hours a day, every single day. And I remember doing that. And I remember looking at that at Coachella being like, yeah, I'm good.
I'm all good.
Yeah. Not for me anymore. Yeah, yeah. You mentioned on the first song on this album, we were talking a little bit before we started, you have a verse or two where you're rapping basically Drake timestamp record style, you know, Jay-Z late period feature verse.
It's interesting you say Drake because I actually thought it was kind of like a singer-songwriter's version of Sicko Mode because there's a beat switch halfway through.
Switch, yeah. And you're basically, you know, listing...
Tracks, by the way.
Yeah, while you're wearing the Texas Jacks. You're going through all of the headlines from your life and career over the last 3 to 5 years. And one of the things you say is, you know, I look down and I see some replacements coming up behind me.
That's every year, by the way. Since I've had success, every single year there's always a new singer-songwriter.
But we're in this moment where the male singer-songwriter is sort of ascendant again. You mentioned Alex Warren. You know, there's Benson Boone out there and a handful of other guys in that mold. Like, do you look at them and feel any jealousy if even now you're on the sidelines or competition or does it get your... Because this verse on opening, the first song on this album, like, it's a little bit chest puffed. Done yet. Like, you mentioned Usain Bolt. Like, you're like, so I'm here.
There's twofold on the chest puffness. So the verse originally was a back-to-back with me and Dave, the rapper. Yeah, so there was an element of me, because his verse was chest puffed, there was an element of me being like, cool, I'm going to do...
Meeting the moment.
Yeah, my thing as well. But no, I found early on in my career, I remember having success on Plus, and then Shawn Mendes released Live for the Party, and then suddenly he was the new singer-songwriter. Yeah, and he was like 15. And I remember looking at that being like, oh, like, yeah, he's the next guy. And I had John Mayer come to a show around that time, and he sat with me backstage and he said, when I was your age, people always said that one day there's going to be someone who comes along and does what you do, but different. And they'll kind of like...
take my belt or my crown.
Sort of. But and he said, and all I want you to know is like, I'm recognizing it's you and I'm really happy for you and I'm here for whatever you need. And I felt that from like Elton John as well. Like, he's always celebrating new artists coming through. And I think from that point, I've always tried to embrace the new people. Like, we sung that song, me and Alex. I know Benson. Like, I feel like I root for any
singer. Your replacements.
Well, yeah, but they're not, because they have their own career. I think it's a bad thing to look at them kind of encroaching on your space, because my space is my space, and people come to my shows, and if I can offer opening acts to new singer-songwriters coming through, then suddenly we're all kind of rooting for each other. And I don't know, I found it a lot. Like, Capaldi's one of my really good friends. Miles Smith is now one of my really good friends. Like, I had some like great moments with Tom O'Dell. Just lots of people coming through, Rag and Bone Man. And the people that I admired, from James Blunt to David Gray and Damien Rice, it's the same thing. And it's a kind of lineage of singer-songwriters. Like, the door, my first record was funded by Paolo Nutini and James Blunt having success on Atlantic.
Yep.
And I know that all the other singer-songwriters in some way have been funded either by record labels looking at either someone like Paolo Nutini or James Morrison or James Blunt or me or Ben Howard or Rag and Bone Man or James Bay or George Ezra or blah, blah, blah. It's kind of a lineage of like each one gets funded.
Allows the next person to take the risk, the creative
and
opportunity.
And if you look at it like that, it becomes a community and everyone sort of feels happy for each other. Rather than fuck this new guy coming in, and you know, I see it as a lineage. I think honestly, it stemmed from Elton, because Elton's done it from the 80s, really, and he rings people. He rung me up when my collaborations project came out in January 2011, speaking to me about Devlin. Yeah. And he's, and I was just like, how do you know? And Elton is just on new music and really encouraging new artists. And I think that there's never underestimate, as you know, I'm not Elton John, but I've had 15 years in a career, and never underestimate what just sending a message to a new artist, being like, hey, I like this song,
sure,
like what that does.
One thing that struck me about that same song, and it's interesting to hear that Dave was on it originally, yeah, because you have throughout your career turned to rapping. You were rapping in the very beginning. You collaborated with grime artists. You collaborated, you played me a record that you did with The Game in like 2014, oh, yeah, or whatever, you know, Yellow Wolf.
Yeah.
Like, you've sort of found moments to both collaborate with rappers, but also rap yourself.
Yeah.
But I wonder, as a songwriter, what can you achieve rapping that you can't achieve with a traditional pop song structure?
I think it's information, getting information in. Mm. I think when you've got a pop song structure, like Azizam, if you look at the verses of that, it's very, very brief.
Yeah.
Like,
not many words.
Not many words at all, but it's all about the melody.
Yeah.
I think there's two different sides of me as an artist. And one would be very melody and hook driven, and one would be very lyrical driven. Like, A-Team originally was written as a multi-syllable rap. The A-Team, they screamed.
Interesting.
And I think that there are different ways of writing songs, but I do think that you can fit in more information with a rap. And I love flowing in, yeah, and out, and catching rhythms and fitting it and doing different things. But yeah, I find myself doing it less and less. And I think it's just because I was in the studio with Dave, and there was a bit of like a, I want to show him
that you still got it.
Yeah.
But is it also yeah, attitudinal? Because obviously the energy on this opening record, it's interesting that the subsequent 12 songs are like, here's beauty. Here's what it's like when you lose beauty.
Yeah.
Here's what it's like when you reclaim beauty. Here's what it's like when you marry beauty. Mm. Like that. But the first song is like, I've been through it.
Yeah.
It's like, I've been on some
shit.
Let me
cleanse the palate.
So Blake, who I made most of the record with, we sat down in October last year.
That's Blake Slatkin.
Yeah. To listen to the record. And it's the first song on the record is Sapphire. And it felt jarring to me to end with, Autumn Variation sort of lives in its own world, but like to end Mathematics with Subtract, which is a really fucking heavy album, mm-hmm, and then just go straight into like, hey, like it's really happy and dancey. And it just felt really jarring to me. And I was like, I need to have a link between the two. There needs to be like a bridge of that was this and this is now. Like, mm-hmm, how did you get to Sapphire from Subtract? So that's what opening is. It starts in Subtract world, and then the sort of rap bit, I guess, is the bridge, and then the end of it. I don't know if you probably listened to it on a stream thing, but on the vinyl, it's all in the same key as Sapphire. So on the vinyl, it goes into this like sparkly world, and then Sapphire begins, and it's basically like draw a line, the day bursts wild and open, and then Sapphire begins. Because I do think Play as a whole is quite a like bright, sparkly, happy,
yeah,
celebratory album.
But you had some stuff you wanted to get off your chest.
Well, you just
first.
Like, how did you get there?
Right.
Like that's what I kept saying. It's like, what the fuck happened in the middle?
Is it also that you want to remind people, like, I'm a human. I had these experiences. Like, I'm not just the guy who makes the hits that soundtrack your life. I also have
I think
my
a little
own
bit
arc.
Of that. Yeah, I think each one of my albums, I think it needs both.
You've done a version of this before.
Like Eraser, I think, is that. I would say One on Multiply has like an element of that. Like One was, Plus was all written about my first girlfriend, and One was like the last song that I wrote about her, and that kind of drew the line, and then it entered into Multiply, which is all about moving to America and stuff like that. So I've done versions of it. Tides on Equals was kind of like that. So yeah, and I think on all albums, I love pop music, and I mean, you guys know, I'm sure you've covered me doing pop songs, yeah, before, but as you said, like sometimes you have to balance it with the heart and feeling. Like it's great having a song with loads of hooks and melodies, but I think an album needs balance, and I think opening is balance. I think a song like For Always is balance. I think In Other Words is balance, Slowly is balance. You need balance that isn't just, is this going to slap at a concert?
Will we ever hear the Dave verse?
No, but me and Dave worked on a lot of music.
He's on here. He's on this album. Some background vocals.
Well, so mate, he's a funny character because he does like, he's a nighttime session guy and I'm not. So he would drive down to mine in Suffolk. We'd do an entire day of studio and then he'd drive back to London, go into the studio at night, produce all the songs up, sleep for like an hour and then drive back down to stuff. It's like a 3-hour drive to my house. But we did that for like a month. He has his methods.
So maybe a collab tape in the future, just the two of you?
Do you know what? I think he wanted to really show the world that he can write songs as well as write raps really well. And he really can. He's an incredible producer as well. Like, it just his sitting down and making things. Like, we made maybe like 4 or 5 songs that come out on a repack at the end of the year. But yeah, he's a really, really talented producer, writer. And I think that this is his way of... And we never even like... There wasn't even a conversation of like, shall we do a collaboration? Obviously, we were going back and forth in the studio, but it felt more natural for him to be like a producer.
Sure.
Because we have collaborated in the past before, sure, as well. But I think it's far cooler that almost he's like secretive. Like, people found out from a like YouTube video of a making of a little more that he was even involved.
You've alluded to this a bit, but you have 2 young daughters now.
Yeah.
You said first day of school today.
Yeah.
And you're in the US. You've said you're moving to America again. Is this where you're sort of your next phase?
Well, I'm touring here
as a family man.
Sort of. I'm touring here for like 10 months and I'm not going to commute from London, you know? Yeah. So
we don't even like commuting from Brooklyn.
Yeah. So I think for me, I want to be around my family. And they're young enough that they're not like locked into high school. So yeah, we're going to do a year in the States. British media are like so on Brits leaving the UK at the moment. They're just like, everyone's leaving the UK and living in the UAE.
It's overplayed.
Oh yeah. And I'm just like, I'm going on tour. And mate, I lived here in 2023 and no one cared. Suddenly people care.
So you have the luxury of being able to bounce around.
Yeah, I bounce from the UK to the US. That's those are the only two. I think my career here doesn't really exist unless I'm here. It's like America, you constantly have to remind people that you exist because there's so much choice, mm-hmm, for music, and there's so much American choice. Like, if I left, no one would notice. It's just, there's so much choice in America.
You, when we first spoke, you talked about how important it was for you to really feel felt in America.
Yeah.
Coming from where you come from, that felt like the sort of the ne plus ultra, like that's the top. But one of the things that you've done, I think, really effectively on the last 3 or 4 albums is you have collaborations with folks who work in other pop styles.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, Azizam on this record, there's Sapphire. In the past, you've collaborated with Nigerian artists and Ghanaian artists. And I wonder, on some level, is that an acknowledgement on your part that actually global pop is not what we used to think of it was in the 80s and 90s, which is just American pop and maybe some British pop.
Yeah.
But actually, there are multiple global pop traditions. And you're sort of, as a thoughtful listener, are like, how do I get in on that as well? Like, and not simply be bound by the traditions that I grew up.
Well, I think it's twofold. I think one of it is growing up in the UK, and London is hugely multicultural. So that would be where, like, I'd say Afrobeat and dancehall, and you sort of grow up around it. Yeah.
You go to Carnival, it's just there.
Totally. Yeah. But also, I think being a touring musician and seeing that sometimes I think as Westerners, we have this view that the West is it, when actually, like, the world is huge. And I think COVID really like localized everything. Like, the biggest rappers in France are not American, they're French.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The biggest rappers in Germany are German. The biggest artists in India are Indian. And I think that COVID localized everything, but it also allowed homegrown superstars to become bigger. And then there's also diaspora from every country everywhere.
Sure.
So if you're big in Denmark, there's a Danish community somewhere in the world. The world itself is getting more global. And more stuff is getting heard. More stuff is like championed and cared about because people want to support their own, I guess. So So I find myself touring and just meeting more people through that. Like, I've toured India, you know, 5 times over the last decade, and every time I go back, I meet new people who introduce me to new things. And I went there in 2024 and I was meant to do a song with Arijit for like a Bollywood film, and then me and Arijit hung out and then we ended up working on Sapphire and blah blah blah. It all kind of happened quite naturally. Like, it's less thought out than people would think. I think.
Yeah, is it ever strategic though? Do you ever say, oh, my ticket sales or my streams are low in this market? Like, it's the only place in the world where I sort of see a dip. Like, if I go in there, embrace the local tradition and really tap in with, you know, people who obviously you have creative kinship with, but is there ever a strategic element to doing an Indian record or doing a Persian song?
No, because I've always sold tickets in India. And weirdly, I actually don't think, like talking to people, I don't think people really want to hear Western artists on Indian music. Like I did a song with a Japanese act. And I was saying, oh, shall I sing in Japanese? And they were like, nah, like Japanese music fans that listen to Western music don't want to hear Western art. So also you have to understand those nuances. But I think in terms of like collaborating with people, I think it's more promo looks. Like I hadn't been to Mexico in a while. So I went to Mexico and we did pop up things in Mexico to, I guess, reheat the market. But I think me doing a song with a Mexican artist coming out of the blue feels weird.
It would have to.
I think if I was in Mexico for a while and then it happened naturally, then it would feel natural. But all of those, like talking about like Fireboy and Burner Boy and stuff, all of that happened like super naturally. That was like them coming to me rather than me going to them.
How do you make sure it doesn't come off as touristic?
Well, I think you've got to sort of re-researched about it, I think. And talk a lot. I spoke even just working with Fireboy. I was like, he sings a bunch of his verse in Pidgin. Mm-hmm. And I was like, can I even do that? And he's like, oh, yeah. And then he was telling me what the bits meant. So I knew exactly what I was like singing. And then I think because the way that I did my verse was very British and me, but then you put that bit at the end with him, it all kind of like felt together. I think like anything, if stuff is done without education or knowledge, it feels odd. And I think that I knew quite a lot about Afrobeat going into that. It wasn't like it was my first foray or even that it was being done to be like the international feature. That all came through Jamal Edwards, who knew Fireboy's A&R really well. And they were like, he has this song. Because Fireboy's favorite artist in the world is Passenger.
Wow.
Yeah, which is like...
And that's your boy, right?
My boy. And I brought Passenger down to... Mike thought that I was taking the piss and I brought Mike down to Fireboy's Wembley show and Fireboy like lost his mind. It was like really... So Fireboy's really, really into like acoustic singer-songwriter music. So when that was explained, then it made sense why he wanted me on the record and we did that. So it all happened. It wasn't just... Ed is a big artist, therefore we want him on the song. Mm-hmm. It was, I really like singer-songwriter music and I don't want to do a feature unless it's this person. And that's how it came to me.
The other thing I would say is it has always felt a little bit like we always talk on the show about the Drake effect, which has gone back for, 10, 12 years, which is Drake is like, I like Migos. I'm going to hop on the Versace remix. It's good for me. And also, it introduces everybody who likes me to this.
Yeah.
And I've always felt when I've heard these songs, there is some aspect where you're like, I know I have ears. I know that people are paying attention. And what's a positive thing that I can do with that attention besides sort of glorify myself? How can I get people who listen to me to also pay attention to Nigerian music?
Well, also, you never know what's going to work. Like, you never know what's going to work. I feel Azizam's a big swing. Mm-hmm. It's a big swing. And if it misses, it misses. But it was really fun to do. Really
fun.
And
it's been embraced by the Persian
hugely,
community.
Yeah, hugely. That was the win for me. Like, my record label said going into it, they're like, we are going to struggle with this in America. And they did. They didn't lie. It happened. But it really, really works within the Persian community. And I think that for me was the win.
Do you have any misses? Or are you like, where the community itself was like, keep that? And you're like, oh, I didn't do my due diligence here?
I haven't had that yet, but I would say I've probably only done it like 4 or 5 times. And it's been like each time has been really but I'd say the real sleeper hit was the Burner Boy For My Hands. Hold you for my hand, hold you for my hand.
Hey, it's John. We're taking a quick break from this Ed Sheeran conversation for our song of the week. We're talking about Megan Maroney. We're talking about country music. We're talking about Men Her Dogs.
Check it out.
Your ex trying to take another pass? Get in. Let's talk about it.
Every decade in country music, it seems like there's one or at least one female singer who's dedicated to the project of dismantling masculinity. I'm thinking Loretta, Dolly, Reba, the Dixie Chicks, Shania, Miranda. And now in the 2020s, it's Megan Maroney. Megan's got two albums so far, and they are full of incredibly clever, wise, arched eyebrow songwriting about the modern feminist condition, which, through her lens, sounds really rough.
All of a sudden, now you're willing and able. Little therapy, now you're so stable.
6 months later is the new Megan Maroney song. It's about a guy who shows up and delivers nothing, and then leaves and decides, wait a minute, I really have something to offer.
Your next girlfriend will be so lucky.
You really feel the handiwork at play in the production. It kind of has the sense of her singing to you from across a table at dinner. It's not bombastic, it's offhanded. It's really delivered in a way that's kind of like, hey girl, you've been through this too, right?
I was barely alive. At 6 feet deep, I was five.
Singers like Megan Maroney often act as a corrective in country music, which is an incredibly male-dominated genre. Bros, post-bros, gentlemen, every shade of guy that you can think of is at the top of the charts. Megan Maroney is not quite successful at that level, but she's been persistent and consistently popular. And that tells me that there's an audience hankering for someone to tell them that everybody else that they're hearing on the radio, those guys are dogs. That was our Song of the Week. You can see the full videos for Song of the Week on the Popcast Instagram and the Popcast TikTok. Those are both at Popcast on those respective platforms. Tap in, like, subscribe. We're doing it every week. And now we're back on the couch, me and Joe with Ed Sheeran.
A miss for me culturally was I did a charity video where I went to Liberia to raise money for comic relief. And now, having worked with Afrobeat artists, there's just ways to do things like that. Like, I don't know if you read about the Band-Aid thing at Christmas. They, like, redid Band-Aid.
Oh, the Bob. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a whole thing. But I think, like, not musically, but I think, like, I've over time been educated on different things by... I think that's the thing. You go through life and you learn things.
You mentioned your friend Jamal Edwards, who you lost a couple of years ago, and this period of depression and the music that came out of it. Like, when were you able to turn that corner in your grief and the relationship between your grief and your music?
I definitely had to sit with it for a while because he died, and then Cherry had her like cancer diagnosis, and then the court case started, and then mid court case, my friend Shane died like the first day as well. So it was like a heavy month, and then I went straight. Oh, and then I went straight into my second child getting born.
Wow,
straight into
great.
Mathematics tour. Then Cherry had the operation to take out the tumor, and then the Mathematics tour sort of ran whilst we were finishing Subtract, and then we went straight into Subtract. So I'd say it was like 2 years of like real cloud.
For anyone who doesn't know, you're referring to your wife's.
Cancer scare
during her second pregnancy.
Yeah. So I'd say it was like 2 years of cloudiness. And yeah, we moved back home and bed in there and got into a routine. And I think that probably creating this as well. I think also when you're sitting on an album or releasing an album that's all about the toughest point of your life, like you can't help.
Dwelling in it.
You can't help but dwell in it. Yeah.
And also, does that account for essentially the brightness of this album? 100%, apart from,
yeah. This is complete knee-jerk reaction of like, this has to be the like brightest Technicolor record that we can make.
And I need to do this for my children, for my family. Like I need to sort
and
of...
It's, mate, and it's fun. Like I'm not playing Eyes Closed in the House to my daughter,
right.
But I'm playing Sapphire. She loves Sapphire. It's like a... I think records like this need to exist. I think that they, like, you need to have fun, upbeat stuff. And Subtract is it's my fan's favorite record of mine. It's definitely the most like heartfelt, deep, emotional record, but it's not a fun record. It's not one that you're going to be putting on when you're getting ready to go out.
You mentioned the court cases. You've been, you know, the subject of some accusations over the years that your music plagiarizes Marvin Gaye, among others. You've settled some cases. You've given credit, like on Shape of You.
We settled one case, and that's why all the other cases came. And I basically,
this seems to be something that really
personal.
That's personal for you.
I went on advice on the first one. They basically said there's this claim that's come, and you can either take it to court, which will take years, and then you'll spend time not touring and it's going to cost this amount, or you give this amount, which was way less,
and you know
I was mid tour and I was like, yeah, cool, done. And because I did that, then that's when the other cases sort of came, because people were like, oh, there's a habit of this, you've settled. And it was just one case that had happened. So with both of those cases, the Shape of You case in the UK and Thinking Out Loud, I think the Shape of You case we actually brought. I think that was us being like, no, we should take this to court. But it was both times me being like, I have to nip this in the bud, and actually just like, I can't just be chucking money and settling for the rest of my life because people think this. So I have to nip this in the bud. And we did. And it was a costly nipping in the bud. But it was
emotionally and financially,
time-wise,
I'm sure.
Also.
Yeah. Well, weirdly, I kind of like the second one actually was less, I think, because I wasn't dealing with two mates having died. But the one in New York felt a bit more like I was achieving something good. Whereas the first one, I just felt like I'd just been beaten down. But yeah, the one here was...
That's with the Marvin Gaye estate over Thinking Out Loud and Let's Get It On.
Yeah.
But you took it to trial.
I took it to trial and we won. And I feel like I actually like achieved something positive from all of that time.
Which is what?
Well, I mean, the Dua Lipa case never went to court. I mean, like it has set a
precedent. Right?
I've definitely set a precedent.
I wonder if other songwriters after that happened.
They did.
They came to you privately, I would imagine, and said, thank you.
No one did it before, though. So I think
a lesson for y'all.
I think everyone was seeing what would happen. And afterwards I think it's, no one does it. Everyone settles behind the scenes. It's not good PR being called a thief publicly and saying that you'd like... And that stain is always there. That stain for the rest of my life. There is people out there, because I had 8 years of people saying it, that stain is always there. It's not good PR. Every single artist that you will talk about on this at some point has settled quietly.
Sure.
Every single one. And to actually... take it to court and set a precedent, it is a positive thing. It wasn't a fun thing to do, but it definitely has helped.
And why did you feel like you needed to be the person to sort of put yourself and your songwriting on the line in that way?
Because I hadn't done anything wrong, and I'm not a piggy bank for someone to like prod and chuck money at.
Right.
You know, I actually wanted to be like, I haven't. And sitting in court and being able to say that, there's some sort of vindication where you see people actually go, oh yeah, actually, fuck, you're right.
When you get to show them the chords.
It's very effective.
You see all the things click. Even with like the other side, you start seeing things click and you're like...
Is it true that you now record yourself writing everything?
I've done that since 2017. So since the second court case came in.
As like preemptive defense.
And it helps. We've had claims come. And you just send them all the raw footage.
And you never hear from them again.
Literally.
I mean, I wonder, as a singer and a pop star, but who is also a songwriter, when you think about how many songs are written these days, they're written collaboratively, piece by piece, a top line, like all these things. You do a tremendous amount of the labor yourself. When these claims are being issued against you, do you feel like it's actually an attack on all of your artistry, that they're trying to invalidate, not just, hey, you stole this bit of this song, but also this guy doesn't belong here? Did it feel personal on that level?
A tiny bit. I think I think Perfect came from that scenario, because Thinking Out Loud was my biggest love song at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then that lawsuit happened. And I think I wanted to prove
I can do it again. Yeah.
But on my own as well. Yeah. Like, no co-write. I'm going to write a song 100% me and I'm going to put it out and it's going to be as successful or not. So I think that, yes, it comes from that. But then that also drives things as well. And yeah, I think that, I think I have a lot of my career of people being like, why the fuck? Why are you doing well? I think people are confused with it. And maybe it stems from that of being like, well, you must have stolen something to get in this position. Mm-hmm.
You know? You also say in the opening song, you talk about, I took my fair share of ridicule and, you know, I'm never the coolest, but I've also been around the longest. Yeah, like, it's interesting. We're talking quite literally in year 14 or 15 of your career. And that's still a thing that you feel like you need to say.
Oh,
which
yeah.
I'm still, I mean, not that I don't want to stand on business and say things like that all the time, but why? Because I think you can very plausibly just be like, I mean, my point's already, I won the court cases, I have the number one hits, I've got collaborations, I have the huge stadium tours. I don't need to say this anymore.
But the chip on the shoulder remains.
That's what I'm saying. That is still here.
Yeah, mate. But I am still a punchline to jokes and people, you know, I feel like when Bad Habits came out, no one liked it. I feel like when Shivers came out, no one liked it. It's only like 5 years down the line where people are like, it was actually an all right pop song. But I think like, I think people are,
You're a huge music fan. I think, you know, I was having this conversation recently with Doja Cat where she's like, you know, I know my pop songs are huge. When I listen to them, I'd rather be listening to something better. Like, is there any part of you, you know, I think Taylor went through this too. I think that's what Folklore was a reaction to. Oh, I'm not a serious artist, no matter how many accolades I have. Like, do you feel like there's a play at some point in what remains of your career where you're like, I'm going to make an album that all critics love, like, do you like that gets a best new music on Pitchfork?
Yeah,
like, is there any part of you?
Oh, if there are any critics left,
like, because I feel like can you think on multiple levels. So I think that you can see that.
Can you imagine creating a record for Pitchfork to like?
Obviously, would work,
and then they don't like it.
Right,
and
you failed in your task.
Right.
My whole thing is, do I like it? Mm-hmm. Do I like if I love it? And I've loved everything that I put out. You mentioned Doja Cat not wanting to listen to her songs. I listen to my songs. I like my songs. And if I put out a song I don't like and it does well, I have to play that for the rest of my life.
Right.
If I put out a song that I don't like and it doesn't do well, I'll always go, why the fuck did I release that? You have to love your stuff. Mm. You have to. And you know, like, I think Divide is... a great record and it did really well and critics savaged it.
Mm.
So like, how am I, like, what am I meant to do to make people like my music? Or should I just make music that I like and carry on doing it? There has never been a stadium that we can't do in the world globally. There's never been a time I've released a record and people haven't at least cared. Even if they don't like it, they haven't at least cared.
Sure.
So if I can still release records and people care and if I can still tour, why would I want anything more?
All that's convincing, and yet you still seem to have this little bug in your ear where you're like, but I'm still a punching bag and I, you know, I'd like
no,
to...
but I am. But
right.
I am.
But do you want to erase that? Or or you think it keeps you going in some way?
I don't know what a fucking good Pitchfork review would do for me.
I mean, the Pitchfork thing is just a stand-in. Of course, you don't need Pitchfork. They need you way more than you need them. But I'm using that as a stand-in to sort of, what would it look like for Ed Sheeran to not be a punching bag among music fans?
Well, do you know what? I'm looking at Chris Martin recently, and I do think that, like, at some point you transcend all of it. And I think he is in, Coldplay as a whole are transcend, because they were punching bags for years. I'm a huge Coldplay fan. I grew up listening to their music.
Yep.
I will always tell him that he's massively influential to
me. Speaking of that lineage.
But they were a punching bag for years. And I think that there becomes a point in your career, Phil Collins definitely hit that point where you transcend it. And I think that I'm not at that point yet. Backstreet Boys.
And it's transcended mentally.
Yeah, Backstreet Boys are transcending it now. Mm-hmm. Like, Britney Spears transcended. These are people that in the 90s were not considered cool, but the songs like live on, and eventually the kids that are into the song, there'll be like a 5-year-old that's into Bad Habits.
Yeah.
In 25 years' time, they're not going to care.
Totally. Even like Fleetwood Mac or Hall & Oates or, you know, music
Fleetwood
that was...
Mac, not cool back then.
It was considered corny, like,
really?
and soft at a time,
it was
and
very
overly commercial.
Gives us all hope, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. But I think you see this in other realms of culture too. I was thinking about it this last weekend with Djokovic at the U.S. Open. Like, yeah. I remember when Djokovic used to get booed at the U.S. Open, or certainly not rooted for. But you stick around long enough, and people are like, "Ah, oh, this guy. We know him. We love this guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's a villain. Maybe he's what not our taste of a player, but like he's 38 and he's still here, and yeah. Now we give him his flowers."
I reckon there might be an element of that eventually. You just kind of got to outlast it.
It does remind me of something that happened, and it's a story I've told to Joe a couple of times over the years. But when we spoke in 2013 or 2014, we were in Texas and we spent many hours together and played a bunch of music for me. And, you know, like I'm sort of like wrapping up at the end of the day, like tape recorder's off, getting ready to go back to the hotel. And you sort of like pull me aside. And you're kind of like, can I ask you a question? And then.
Do you know where he's going with this? Do you remember this at all?
No. I don't remember I remember the day really well. I remember we went to barbecue and all that.
We went to barbecue,
stuff, yeah.
We're at Austin Limits. And you're like, do you rate my music? And I thought that was a baffling question. And for those who don't speak British, that means, do you like my music? And I'm literally like, I've just spent the entire day talking to you, like, hopefully, like, sincerely and with curiosity. And also, I wouldn't have gotten on a plane if I didn't. But I thought it was strange and weirdly refreshing that you could entertain the idea that a person wouldn't like your music, mostly when you talk to someone at that stage.
Most British journalists are that, though. I have, like, and I get on with all of them, but yeah. I know they don't really like my music. Yeah.
And it's fine. Like, you're fine with that. But that's what...
Everyone's here to do a job.
Dude, it is not Pray For Me out here. Like, I've just finished a tour. We played 10 million people. Like, it's not...
You're good.
There is part of me sometimes that is confused... with the narrative, like the narrative around Azizam being like a predictable pop hit, I was like,
"No, that's
where has that come from, or is that just sort of like journalism where it's just copy and paste?" But yeah, I'd say like journalists are journalists. Everyone has to do their
you
job.
Were sort of, so the question was more like, "Are you here just doing the job, or like do you actually
never
see
know?
Do you see the vision? You fuck with the vision,
yeah,
yeah, okay, that was."
I will say I've always loved you, and I've always loved your honesty, because I have dipped in and out of this podcast before, and I do actually respect the honesty. Even this interview, I feel like there's no fluff about it.
Yeah. See you eye to eye. Yeah.
We're trying to also turn this space, which people I think often mistake for a space of just people hang out. Like you sit on a couch hang out and nothing important happens. And we're like, but what if something important happened?
What if
we had a real conversation?
Yeah.
So thank you. Thank you for being game for it.
Yeah, and I know. And it's the other reason I think it's interesting to speak to you about is like not every artist can see both from inside and the narrative. Like you, I can tell instantly from the way you talk about music, the state of pop, your own music, and how it's seen. Like you can view it from multiple angles.
Inside,
you have some self-awareness. You see the playing field. A lot of artists don't like to see the playing field. They only want to exist within the helmet.
Yeah.
You know. But you seem to have a savviness of an observer and a close listener. So I think it's always interesting to speak to someone at your level who can also see the level that they live at.
Yeah.
It's not that journalism. Criticism is perceived as adversarial, but it's in the current climate, it's distinctly non-promotional, which I think can be hard, especially for a lot of younger artists who grew up in a pure promotional environment, to understand that a conversation like this can happen.
Yeah.
But you knew it was very clear from, it seems like day one, that conversations like this were going to happen. They were an inevitability in a way.
Oh, yeah. I think for me, not necessarily from day one. Mm. I remember being really heartbroken that the NME didn't like my music, because I had a subscription to the NME as a kid. And I remember being like, I like this magazine. Yeah. Why don't they like me? And they were like really mean. They did like a full-on online hate campaign.
One of their specialties.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's its own honor, you know. But does the self-awareness ever weigh you down? Do you ever wish like you didn't want to analyze it from all angles and you could just enjoy the success?
I think it's kind of part and parcel, though. You sort of have to retire from giving a fuck, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if I'm at that point yet. I think that to be in the top echelon of pop, you have to be you have to want to work hard. You have to, like, if I didn't give a fuck, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't even be in America. I'd just be like, oh, I'm going to
just drop the record and tell me how it does.
Yeah. So you have to, like, and I still really care that people actually hear this music. And as I said, like, to be in a space where, like, people come to shows and they care that your album's out. Like, I don't want to release an album into a void and no one knew it came out. I want people to at least, like, listen to it, form an opinion.
Do you think you're helped, that it helps keep your feet on the ground, that so much of your circle and even your wife are people that you knew before fame?
Yeah.
That seems like a crucial ingredient, especially for essentially a child star. You became famous as a teenager. Like, that's really hard on people.
It's interesting you say that.
But people who I think have some tether to their life pre-fame, like, that seems to be something that's been important to you. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I really feel like I've got a core group of friends that have been the same since I was 11. Maybe even younger. Like the guy, like Josh, he's actually in town at the moment. He tours with me, but I've known him since I was like 8. And it doesn't really, there's no one new in there. Unless someone gets a partner and blah, blah, blah. It's like the same group of people. And I trust all of them implicitly. And yeah, I think it's important. And people, they tell me if I do weird shit and they will, like, in a different way to the honesty with, like, music critics. I think honesty from friends comes from, like, a loving place and trying to help. Whereas I sometimes, obviously, like, critics are just critical of the thing that you've made.
Right.
But I think as a human being, it's good to have people in your life that will, like, call you out on things.
So you're not surrounded by yes men?
No. No. kind of the opposite.
Really? You're surrounded by no man.
Yeah, well, I sort of feel like I lost a bit of confidence in my music because I write so many songs, and like my management or my label, they know the sort of level that I should be at. And for songs a 9 out of 10, they won't say it's good, even if it's a 9 out of 10.
So when did you lose that confidence?
I think when I stopped, I'd say from 2011 to 2019, everything I put out worked. Everything. I'd release it, it would go platinum. And I think when that stopped happening and you start going, wait, do I know? Do I kind of know? So I think that's when you start losing a bit of confidence.
When I listen to the songs on this album, particularly in the middle section, I think, okay, like, I hear that it's almost like Sheeran core at this point. It's like you're almost referring back to gestures that you have made and revising them in real time on new songs. And as you've done that, the universe is shifting, right? Like when you first came out, did Drake exist? You know, Drake barely existed. You know, like so many things around you have changed. And I wonder what you think about staying the course. And has it been challenging for you to know that an Ed Sheeran hit in 2025 actually has quite a lot to do with an Ed Sheeran hit in 2015, while the universe has radically reshaped?
Yeah, well, I think nostalgia is always a huge part of anyone's, like, because we're Azizam and Sapphire are in the sort of top 100 global sphere, but so's Shape of You and so's Photograph and so's Thinking Out Loud. Like, so nostalgia, people are always listening to shit that they're familiar with. And I think that when you're making new records, there has to be some element of that. Like a song like In Other Words could fit on Multiply. And I think there has to be some element of that whilst trying to push the needle of doing things that you haven't done before. So that's where like Sapphire and Azizam come in as like, is this new and interesting, but then also there has to be like a healthy balance on the record of stuff that feels comfortable.
Yeah, it was, to me, it was Camera and then In Other Words, where I was like, okay, like this is...
I love the Sheeran core element.
Yeah,
core,
it's like Sheeranalia, you know?
Yeah.
It almost feels like a meta Ed Sheeran song.
Well, I think that I think the moment my fan base might have disconnected with me was when I did the collaborations project, because I don't think there was any Sheeran core on them. I think it was all like, I'll try this and I'll try this and I'll try this and I'll try this. And I think that you always have to have some element of like
core thing.
Although the Bieber record came out of that, I feel like because you guys had you'd written Love Yourself, etc. I feel like there was some of that there.
I do feel like that record could have been a 6-track EP.
Mm.
And
which you had done in the past. Like you've done similar, like you did a grime EP.
It was a
like in 2012 or 13?
Yeah, I think...
Go check that out.
My record label said to me if I basically made it 15 songs, it would count as an album option. So I was like, cool. And actually, looking back at it, I probably should have just made it a 6-track.
Yeah.
Put it out, had the Bieber song, had the Khalid song, had the Stormzy song, had the Eminem song.
And then just kept it pushing.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. I don't regret anything in my career, but I think that is one thing that I would do again if I could.
But the collaborations are interesting because one thing, you talked about Elton John earlier and how sort of tapped in he is with what's happening with new music. Your collaborations let me know that you are also doing the same thing for younger generations. Are you paying attention to the current UK underground stuff? Like, where are you on Fake Mink, Fang, Finny Guerrero, SD Kid? Like, where are you on? You've got to be tapped in on that.
Keeping plugged in. I'm trying to stay more plugged in regionally. I think there's actually like really exciting stuff coming out of like Leeds and Bradford and Liverpool. And
who should we tap in on Leeds? Leeds Wave.
There's a guy called Mazza from Liverpool who is really having a moment. He made like, I remember listening to it. He made a whole record in jail, but I guess he recorded it on a phone with beats and then mixed it outside. But it's a really, really interesting record to listen to. And then, I don't know, I know Dave's not new, but Dave has a new record that's coming out. There's a couple of things coming out. But yeah, I like that you're staying plugged into it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like
it's an exciting time.
Yeah, it feels like it's maybe the most exciting emergent scene happening right now. It's the scene that
I think it's getting more regional because usually it's just London.
But that's also like in a weird way that's an American thing where like you think about like Memphis rap, Houston rap, etc. Like it's interesting to hear that that's
small town Florida.
Well, it used to just be New York rap.
Yeah.
So I think it's happening, and there's so many stories over the UK, and everyone also. The UK is small, but each place has its own different slang and dialect.
So we're going to hit a couple questions from our lightning round.
Cool.
You'll pull a card. Each card corresponds to
a preset list of questions.
Podcast question from our questionnaire.
Sweet.
Some of them deep, some of them playful.
Great.
But you take your pick.
Okay. Is that clubs?
That is clubs. Okay. We kind of talked about this a little bit already, but I think it's worth diving into. What sparks your jealousy? And if it's not...
Oh, songs.
If it's not the success of an Alex Warren, songs? No. Good songs.
Good songs.
What was the last one that you heard and you're like,
fuck.
Sky Newman, Family Matters. Have you heard that?
No, I'm going to get on
my
that.
My God, that song's amazing.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Aaron Rowe, Haymar. Have you heard that? If you can check these out. But Aaron Rowe, Haymar, and Sky Newman. I don't get jealous in a way. Yeah. I get jealous in a wow, I'm inspired way.
Motivation.
Like I need to like go in and step up my game sort of thing. Yeah.
What about personal jealousy?
Outside of music, or career.
I don't know, actually. I don't know if I get as in jealous of someone else in my position or
jealous of another person's life, their success, their family.
Are you jealous of privacy?
Yeah. I'm jealous of my friend's normality. Yeah. I'm jealous that my best mate can take his daughter to the park and push her on a swing, or take her to Disneyland or a zoo. I'm really jealous of that.
Have you considered shutting down Disneyland so you could take your
But then that in itself is weird, and then your kid kind of grows up being in line
to appreciate the ride.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely jealous of normality. And I know that it's a trade-off that happens, and I know that my friends are jealous of me for having wealth and success. So there is a trade-off of the grass is always greener on the other side, but
an open conversation between you guys?
Yeah, totally. And I think they can see how difficult it is to mourn things with my daughters that I'll never get to do, in the same way that I can recognize difficulties in their life as well.
Pull another card.
Cheers. Nine of spades.
Nine of spades.
Sorry, I'm not like a big card.
You're not a card guy. No Vegas tables for you.
You're really picking the...
No, I've done them. I did actually. The last time I went was with Mayo after I went to go and watch the Grateful Dead show.
Okay. That he was the in Sphere?
It. Yeah, and we did a bit
at
of blackjack.
Sphere, sorry, no the.
Yeah, just Sphere.
Just Sphere, yeah.
Sphere.
You played some blackjack with Mayer.
We played some blackjack, but I think he was kind of like taking it a bit more seriously than I was. And eventually I was like, I think I'll just leave you to it.
Yeah. He's a very focused guy. He's very leaned in. Okay, you're picking intense questions. Spiritually, you're aligned with our lightning round. What usually makes you cry? What's the thing that's the easiest path to crying?
Probably something linked in with Jamal. Like it was his birthday again recently. I'm in touch with his mum and sister like most days. So something like that. Just because that's such a like, that is just a heartbreaking, sad story that there is no light at the end of the tunnel. It's just really sad. So yeah, I'd say stuff like that. And I don't think that when you lose people like that in your life and it's that sudden that you ever really get over it at all. I think it's always there. So yeah, I get like, that will make me cry quite a lot.
Does that, and is it creep up on you in unexpected moments and ways?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it does. Mostly like the days that are eventized, whether it's his birthday or the day that he died or, yeah. Like I find myself just going back and watching loads of the videos that he made and kind of like having nights where I'm just on my own and do a deep dive. But yeah.
Feel it.
Yeah.
Let yourself feel it.
I think it's good to feel it. I think it's bad to like block it out, pretend it doesn't exist.
You have to allow yourself to feel it.
Totally.
All right. Pull another card. Maybe you'll get a fun one.
Maybe he doesn't. Like this, maybe he doesn't want a fun one.
I feel like this interview could be like 5 hours long.
Yeah. If you want to stay.
Three of spades.
What the hell?
Another one?
Unbelievable. All right, maybe you answered the question also a little bit already. What do you do when you get lonely? And actually, maybe the corollary question to that is, given how big your enterprise is, do you even have the opportunity to get lonely?
I think about this all the time because my friend, I have two mates that are both first child and they go on holidays on their own all the time. And I look at it and I'm like, I don't know if I could do that. I actually hate being on my own. I don't think I'm actually ever on my own. I'm always like, there's always someone there. Mm-hmm. Even if I'm home, there's a security guard there. Yeah, or sure. Like, so I think I'm terrified of being lonely, actually.
Yeah.
I think that is a definitely a thing. But maybe that's growing up with a brother, and he was always there, and then I moved out of home and I was always with someone or staying at someone's and then going on tour, and I was always, I find it also difficult to be in one place because I think my entire life has been on the road.
In motion.
Yeah. So
but you can be surrounded by people and still be lonely.
Yeah.
Big spill.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely.
Just saying.
I think that's more, I would say I feel more lost than lonely if I'm surrounded by people and I'm kind of like, no one really is in sync with how, I'd say that's me feeling lost rather than me feeling lonely.
Fair enough. Or
like not heard or something. I don't know.
All right, let's pull two more for a full
hand. Yeah, I know, you really.
Until you get a funny question.
King of Diamonds.
Okay, fine. Jeez. What a relief. I'm going to say it's movie or album, but I think album's cheating. What's a movie that you know front to back?
Goodfellas and Love Actually, I'd say are the two that I watch.
Those are the two sides of your personality?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I watch Love
Actually. The rapping and the singing.
Yeah.
I would say that there's an element to my music that is very Richard Curtis movie. I think British heart, love.
Yep.
I think, it's very...
It's Christmas.
Yeah. And I don't think there's a single end of my music that's like Goodfellas, to be honest. But
these bars on the first track.
I bought the knife from the first scene of Goodfellas. I got it from Crop Store. Auction. Yeah, yeah.
Well, like the actual
one. Yeah,
incredible.
I tend to like. I was meant to just only buy movie props on my birthday, and then like the prop store place every now and then will be like, "Hey, we got this if you want it."
Like, they're like, "They know we got something you might like." What else? Or give us your top three movie props you own other than the
I need to know, like
Rufio's sword.
Incredible.
Plus Pan's outfit from Hook.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Where it's just like in a display case?
It's in my house. I wore it for a bit. Because I was like, And then I was like, is this disrespectful to wear this? Should I put this in a case? So it's in a case now. But,
incredible.
I mean, it's not like the Queen's vet.
Yeah, it's Hook. You know, it's fine. It's playful.
No, but man, that for me is like my favorite Robin Williams film. It's like,
that's the ultimate.
What else? I bought the Jumanji set, the original one.
Like, cool. the board game, with the pieces.
So real Robin Williams core.
Yeah, real Robin Williams core.
Is that your guy? That's your guy?
Yeah, Robin Williams is my guy. Yeah. I am. What else would you like that's cool? Oh, the bear from Artificial Intelligence, you know, running AI.
Wow.
That was actually a gift.
Where do you even buy these? I wouldn't even know.
He has a plug, obviously. This one's saying, like, I know he's their guy.
I don't know where to buy everything. I don't know where to buy this.
The ones that I've been getting for really good value are my favorite Batman, and this will show you the type of person that I am. My favorite Batman film is the Batman and Robin film.
Wow, Because
I was like six when that came out.
That's crazy, though.
Same for like my favorite Star Wars film is Phantom Menace. For the same reason,
yes.
Sure.
Also crazy,
but because no one liked Batman and Robin,
you could buy the whole set.
All those costumes are like pretty cheap.
Is that the nipple suit?
Yeah.
Is that in the house? That's in the crib. You might wear that one around.
I think I'd wear. I just bought Robin's.
Wait,
outfit,
is it? Maybe. It's you.
It's
Clooney, you and the wife.
Right? Yeah, you might wear the Batman nipple. You know.
I've got Batgirl as well. So you know.
Incredible.
Wild time at the Sheeran household.
Yeah,
incredible.
Just like, what are they called? Furries?
Furries.
Just like the opposite of furries.
it's cosplay. It's superheroes. It's cosplay. No furries in this house.
First of all, no kink shaming on podcast. No kink shaming.
Yeah.
This is actually a more revealing question than the deep ones.
He's like reaching for the cards.
Yeah, another one. Nine of diamonds.
All right, nine of diamonds.
Oh, okay. This is actually... I wonder, this is a good question generationally. How many people's phone numbers do you have memorized?
None.
Not a one.
Zero.
Maybe my dad's mobile number. Only because it was the same as our home number as a kid.
Mm-hmm. But anything after that, time-wise, just you never had to memorize it.
Yeah. Yeah. I kinda...
So you'd be lost if the phone falls. If you just stranded on the streets of New York, you'd be lost.
Yeah. I haven't had a phone for a very, very long time. And if I don't take my iPad out with me, I am fucked.
Right. You're no smartphone guy.
No smartphone guy. Oh, wow. And I am, my wife was playing hockey somewhere in London and I thought I knew where it was. So I drove from our house.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, I don't fucking know where this is. The car didn't have
GPS.
It was like an older car. I didn't have my thing. So I just found myself like stopping on the street and asking people. And people kept looking at me and being like,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm fucked if I'm left on my own.
What's the other biggest downside of not carrying a phone? Like, you don't even have a flip phone.
No.
So what's the other, like, what other situation do you find yourself in where you're just like, I wish I had
I've lost touch
iPhone.
With, like, every rapper that I ever knew because they do not do email.
FaceTime or DM.
Yeah. So I'd say 2015, I was in touch with, like, everyone from Game to Weekend to fucking whoever. And then when I got rid of it, it was just like, well, I guess...
I'll never hear from a rapper again.
Yeah, but if they wanted to reach you, like if the Game is watching right now and says, damn, I'm trying to tap in, how would...
So I go on my Insta DMs maybe like once a month.
Yeah.
And like I speak to him on there. And that's like how I would speak to like Central C. We're in touch on there. And
sure.
Who else was the
So you can get into your DMs. You just don't have them at your fingertips.
Yeah, but the DMs stress me out, man.
Sure.
That's another question that's on our list that Bad Bunny had a great answer to. But yeah, like do you read your own DMs? And do you go into the crazy mailboxes?
I did that once, and the first message was from... There was one from Little Dirk and one from Tom Brady, and I was like, how the fuck did I miss these?
They gotta fix that. Instagram, you gotta fix that.
Know,
Tom Brady only goes to the main folder.
Yeah. But they'd been left on, like, unread for, like, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And I saw it, and I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, sorry, Tom. Sorry, Dirk.
Yeah. I've been messaged... Because he has bought Birmingham City Football Club, so uh-huh. I've been messaged him a bit about
rival owners now.
Yeah, we are. I don't really know him well like that, but I love that we can have like a little banter about our football teams. Weirdly,
incredible.
But yeah.
No, you have to get out the door. Fatherhood duties. We end every episode of Popcast with a snack. You
have you tried a knickknack?
No.
They slap.
So you walked in.
So you say.
You saw something familiar. You didn't want something foreign to you. You wanted something comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're going to try these knickknacks. These are rib and sauce, yeah. Which I said is going to be...
Rib and saucy.
Rib and saucy.
I think these might actually have been taken off the market in the UK. I never see these anymore.
I bought these about 6 or 7 weeks ago when I was in London.
In the UK.
In the UK. Shout out.
You can smuggle them back. Is that still allowed here?
It's allowed for air travel. It's unbelievable. Shout out to everybody who was with me in the corner shop.
You just shelve it.
First of all, you want to talk about kink shaming. that's rude. They said when we saw this, they immediately grabbed it. I was out to dinner with a few music writers. We went to the corner shop afterwards. They grabbed this and they were like, you absolutely have to try these. I literally have no idea what this is.
Can you read the promo?
Okay, you read the promo, then you describe what you believe we're going to experience.
All right, so this is knickknacks. Knobbly, wacky sticks of corn.
Not even words.
I don't know knobbly. Intensely tasty, unusually knobbly. What the hell is knobbly?
I think they're akin to Cheetos.
Okay.
I think. But, mate.
What is knobbly?
Cheetos are a little bit knobbly, aren't they?
No, but literally, what is knobbly?
Define knobbly. Literally, like...
So, like, your knuckle, that would be knobbly.
Gnarled.
No, just like, yeah, like little
a Cheeto.
Little bumps.
All right.
Places. I'd say they're akin to Cheetos, but I'm not trying to rag on American food, but...
No. Sounds like you are.
There are laws in the UK of what you can and can't put in food, right. So I would say...
They're working on that now.
I'd say they're a little bit more... Do you know that apparently McDonald's fries in the UK have three ingredients, right. Potato, whatever the...
Oil and
salt. And here there's like 100 ingredients in them or something.
And
like
they also took out, they made us, they took our beef tallow from our American McDonald's.
I do want to say those other 97 ingredients are delicious though. So yeah, I don't know what y'all are missing out.
All right, let's eat some knickknacks. I see what you mean. They're just Cheetos.
Well, so, I mean, they taste better than Cheetos.
All right, so I've always thought I wanted a steak flavored Cheeto.
Rib and saucy. That's our rap duo.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Me and you.
I haven't had one in ages.
Which
you
one's
me?
Oh. Yeah, come on, dog.
That takes me back to my childhood.
First of all, the smell.
Oh, my God.
It's good.
That bangs.
It's a barbecue-flavored Cheeto.
All right. It has that, the vinegary, kind of like the high...
Try it.
They have another one called a hot and spicy.
So that's like a Flamin' Hot.
Yeah, but they're not that hot.
Not as hot as a Flamin' Hot.
All right.
No, Flamin' Hot Cheetos, they're
legit hot.
You know what I'm really excited good. About that we just don't do in the UK?
Spice.
No, Sunday football day.
Yeah.
When I used to be here and like it was the only time Bud Light ever tasted good.
Oh, yeah. Take it back. You got it.
You're a Titans fan.
I'm a Titans fan.
What's up with that? I know you lived in Nashville.
I lived in Nashville. I went to Walmart when I got to Nashville and I bought some... pajama bottoms, and I got home, and the person I was with was like, "Oh, you're a Titans fan," and I was like,
"I guess I am."
And yeah, it's just been that, and I feel like Titans are like Ipswich, my hometown soccer club.
Lovable losers.
Yeah, but they're gonna have their day, and when they have their day, people like me will go, "We fucking told you."
Yep.
This is why I stopped caring about sports when I was 14. I don't have this kind of patience.
Our pal Jelly Roll put up a story this weekend.
Big Jelly.
Saying, I love that guy.
Titans fans, like, it's our time. I know we had a couple rough years. Like, we're looking at things are looking up.
I believe it. I met Jelly Roll with Yellow Wolf back in the day.
I bet you did. Yeah. I can only imagine what Yellow Wolf and Jelly Roll were doing in 2012.
I'm going to eat one more of these because I think they have more nuance than I expected.
Yeah,
I think it's a strange flavor.
Can I talk about texture for a minute?
I like the texture. It's airy.
It collapses into dust immediately, and then it becomes mealy in a way that I don't find unsatisfying. But to me, I wouldn't say it's a... Forgive me. Forgive me. I wouldn't say it's a terribly elegant snack.
No.
I mean, it is, like most of our snacks, expired.
I have two... two modes in the UK. If I'm eating, it's either like proper let's fucking scum out and we're having a dirty kebab and that's some of me. That and blah, blah, blah. Or it's like an elegant.
Okay, well, no, Scum Out is now the name of our snack segment.
Yeah. If you're going to get arrested for stealing a horse, you might as well fuck it. You know?
Big spill. Big spill.
Never heard that one before. All right, out of 10, I feel like you're going 10. Are you going 10 out of 10 on these?
On the snacks? Nah, 8. I wouldn't say they're the
He's
best
an
crisps.
Honest guy.
I'm not saying the best crisps in the UK. I think the best crisps in the UK, honestly, we have a supermarket that's like, this is what me and my wife bang on a daily basis, is that actually is could be taking out.
Yeah, it does. Not that
no,
one.
No, we eat a lot of them on a daily basis. Do you know what Tesco's is?
Yeah,
it's
of course.
Kind of like,
yeah,
what
yeah.
would Tesco's equivalent be here?
There's a shop. The shop, but it's Tesco's it's like not as fancy yeah, yeah. as Whole Foods. Yeah. Like a ShopRite or Gristini's yeah.
but they
in
do
New
a,
York.
A crinkle cut crisp, and it's called Tesco's Finest.
Mm-hmm. It's house brand.
Salt and vinegar,
crinkle,
fucking
house
hell,
brand.
Man.
Okay.
I would smash like 4 bags of them in a row. Okay. I think they're the top tier.
Right, so that's a 10 and this is an 8.
Yeah, maybe a 6, you know.
Ah, all maybe right, you're coming 6. Down on the knickknacks.
This is honestly,
after some big talk.
I want to be honest, like, it's actually really refreshing that you don't feel culturally that you are forced to say that this is a 10.
I think that there's a lot of things in the UK that I would, like, stand my ground on and be like, you have to love, but, you know. There's also some cuisine in the UK. Someone pointed this out to me the other day, and they were just like, it's just, like, mashed potatoes and then, like, a sloppy thing. And you're like...
Yeah, hard to argue.
When I lived there, I struggled with the cuisine adoption because I couldn't quite get past that thing.
I think
thing.
Because you're going to the wrong places.
Well, next time you let me know.
Well, London's interesting because I actually think some of the best food in London is blends of cultures. Yeah. Sure. But yeah, certainly Indian. But I think,
shout out to Shum.
I think amazing Indian food, again, regionally, if you're traveling around the UK, fish and chips, you're going to get regionally great. Yeah, this is, if you are going anywhere, like if I'm coming to America and I go to the capital city, you'd be like, that's not the place. Washington ain't the place to get this. It's the same in the UK. Like London is great, but if you want a real experience of the UK, get trains to Birmingham or Manchester or Liverpool.
I'm going to say 6.5. I like them. They're very interesting. Never had anything quite like it. Would eat the rest of the bag. I'm a 6.5 out of 10.
I feel like I'm like climbing up a sand hill and like the 10th or 20th would wreck me. So I'm going to go 5.5. I'd be interested. There's multiple flavors of this thing. Or this is just...
I think there's three.
This is the canonical flavor.
I don't know what canonical means.
Yeah, it's the one, the definitive
defining.
One.
Oh,
the
right.
Definitive one.
Hot and spicy, I think, is the definitive one.
Okay.
It depends who you ask. It's kind of like Doritos,
sure.
you know?
There's like 2 canonical Doritos flavors.
What would be canonical? Now I'm three. Learning words
now three.
Here. This is good.
Now three.
Right.
The purple bag has
purple
entered,
bag has become
has entered the villa.
Yeah. What's the purple bag?
Spicy sweet chili.
Right.
It's regular.
I always thought I'd get a call from
Spice Sweet
Doritos. I mentioned them in Galway Girl. I always thought I'd get a call from them.
It's not too late.
It's time.
It's literally not too late.
Where's my call?
Bang at line. We could do this for hours, I'm confident.
We honestly could. This has been really fun.
Get on our Twitch stream. When we have a Twitch stream, you'll come and kick it with us.
Yeah, we'll do 24 next time.
We'll
go from 1 to 24.
I'm round the corner, so anytime you want to do this again.
Pull up. You want to pull up for the end of the year episode?
Fuck yeah.
Let's fucking go.
Yeah. Just take my email off.
No, we're going to take your email. Because there's no phone.
Yeah, no phone.
I'm good on email.
No, okay, great.
I'm good on email.
We're old millennials, right, John?
Sorry. As a Gen Zer.
If I don't reply on email, just know lots of shit's going down in my life.
Fair enough.
Here's the thing. We're going to tap in, and we hope you don't tap out. That's all we have to say. Ed, big thank you. Thank you to everybody in the room. That is our show. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. You can get us on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, any deviant social platform you might be curious about at podcast. We'll be back next week. I don't need a camera to capture this moment.